So Daniel chapter 9, verse 4. A reading from the New King James, and this is Daniel praying to God, and really taking stock. Imagine he's older at this time. He's contemplating what he and his people have been like, and there's a lot of regret here. There's a lot of sadness. But at the same time, there is hope as well. And this is his prayer. We're going to start at verse 4. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession and said, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments. And we have sinned and committed iniquity, which we have done wickedly and rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and your judgments. Neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings and our princes, to our fathers and all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us shame of face, as it is this day to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and all men of Israel, those near and those far off in all the countries to which you have driven them, because of the unfaithfulness which they have committed against you. O Lord, to us belongs shame of face, to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, but we have rebelled against him. We have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. Yes, all Israel have transgressed your law and has departed so as not to obey your voice. Therefore, the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, has been poured out on us because we have sinned against him. He has confirmed his words, which he spoke against us and against our judges who judged us, by bringing upon us a great disaster. For under the whole heaven, such has never been done as what has been done to Jerusalem. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this disaster has come upon us, yet we have not made our prayer before the Lord our God, that we might turn from our iniquities and understand your truth. Therefore the Lord has kept the disaster in mind and brought it upon us. The Lord our God is righteous in all the works which he does, though we have not obeyed his voice. And now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt, the mighty hand, and made yourself a name, as it is this day, we have sinned, we have done wickedly. O Lord, according to all your righteousness, I pray, let your anger and fury be turned away from your city, Jerusalem, your holy mountain, because for our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and your people are a reproach to all around us. Now therefore, our God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications, and for the Lord's sake, cause your face to shine upon your sanctuary, which is desolate. O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes, see our desolations, and the city, which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. Do not delay for your own sake, my God, for your city and your people are called by your name. And just one further reading, please. It's going to be a short reading. This is going to be this time from the book of Ephesians. Chapter 5, verse 8. For you were once in darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. for it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. But all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light, for whatever makes manifest is light. Therefore he says, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. So thank you for bearing with me as I read those. Reading these two passages is a pretty sobering task. Sometimes, as you may know, I work as a lawyer, sometimes work with Mark, and sometimes when you meet a client for the first time, there's an expectation that you're going to have good news for them. They paid sometimes quite a lot of money to see you. It's not cheap, and they're facing serious problems. And very often you sit them down, offer them a cup of tea, try to put them at ease, because sometimes they're even anxious about seeing somebody who is on their side. But sometimes you've got to be honest with them. And right from the outset, there's no point in hiding the truth from them. You've got to be honest with them. And it's an uncomfortable situation. There they are, in your office, looking for good news, to be told, don't worry, you'll be found not guilty. You'll get a walkout. Won't be a problem. And the truth is something different. And you have to tell them that. Sometimes they don't realize how bad a situation they're in. And really, I would be failing in my duty unless I confronted them with the reality, the truth of what their situation actually was. There's a gentleman, there's a friend of a friend who I represented recently, who was in front of the employment tribunal, and he was suing his employer. He'd been sacked. He'd been sacked twice before from different employers, and this was the third time. And as far as he was concerned, he was happy. He was going to get his day in court. He was going to win. I sat down with him, this voluminous amount of paper. We went through it, and we went through it, and we went through it. And I had to look him in the eye and tell him, you're not going to win. You really are not going to win. You've been sacked two times already. This is the third time you've been sacked. Similar circumstances, all in the last 2 years. You're not going to win. You're just not going to win. And the penny just starts to drop slowly and slowly until eventually this chap came round to see things from my point of view. And I think eventually what would have been the tribunal's point of view. Other people, other lawyers out there who would have sat him down and said, don't worry, we'll get this a fight. Come on, we'll just do this and we'll do that. And maybe, you might win. Now that person, the second person, would be failing in their duty. And likewise, this is what the Bible does to us. Sometimes the Bible has a message of comfort. Sometimes that's what we need. Sometimes it's almost like a mother to a small child who's fallen over, picks them up, gives them a kiss, sends them on their way. But occasionally the Bible, fortunately, is a bit like a sergeant major. Sometimes the Bible is like a good lawyer, not a bad one, but a good one, and says, I'm afraid you're going to have a good look in the mirror, because you're not going to win. It's not a pretty picture. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was somebody who was a German in the Second World War, who went back to Germany. He was in America, and he went back to Germany in the middle of the Second World War. And he said that if you board the wrong train, it's no use running along the corridor in the other direction. So we've now, if I can use that metaphor, we've boarded the train of Christ. We are going in that direction. But some of us, we want to get off the train. We want to walk in the other direction. We think, actually, I don't like it. I don't like this direction. I don't like what I have to do as a Christian. We want to get off. But that is not what Christ calls us to do. There's a word in this passage I want to focus on this evening. That's the word expose. I don't know what you think of when you think of expose, but the word here in the Greek is egalon. Doesn't mean anything. It didn't really mean anything to me before a couple of days ago, but it's a word which means to confront, to admonish, to tell off, to reprove. I'm not saying for one second all confrontation is good. You might remember Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers, who always seemed to be having an argument with his wife. Probably some deep-seated difficulty in his marriage. Now, that's not the type of confrontation we're talking about, always having an argument. But the thing is this, is that God does want us to engage in good confrontation. And I'll say that again, God does want us to engage in good confrontation. Why? Because confrontation leads to change, and change can lead to salvation. Unless we confront those idols in our lives, our families, and in our nation, then we will never be changed. And the nation will never be changed. Without the individual being confronted with their sin, without the nation being confronted with its sin and rebelling against God, there will be no revival. There will be no salvation. But we don't like confrontation. We don't like arguments, do we? We just like to try and avoid them. And sometimes people might say, well, blessed are the peacemakers. Well, that is true. That is true. So please don't take what I'm saying to the extreme. Not all arguments, not everybody's confrontational, is on the right path. But ultimately, God calls us to expose the evil deeds of darkness. And ultimately, that's what Christ did, didn't he? Christ was constantly confronted in his life. He was told that he was a blasphemer. He was told he was not the Son of God. He was told that he would not rise from the dead. And what did he do? At times, he confronted those people who said that he was in the wrong. And ultimately, he confronted them through his resurrection by saying, no, you are in the wrong. That word, confrontation, hegelo, is used 17 times in the New Testament, and 3 times in particular in the book of Titus. You know why? The book of Titus is all about elders. It's all about how to lead a church. And so this is especially a message for men in leadership, because they, out of everybody, have to be those who are prepared to say no, to confront what is wrong, and to take the lead in this. Titus chapter 1 verse 9 says, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. And it goes on in verse 13 to say, this testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in faith. And the sad thing is this, is that the world knows how important it is to sometimes confront what is wrong in your company and in your life. I read in Forbes magazine how to be a good leader, and it said, the first thing you have to do is confront reality head on. It says, ditch those rose-coloured glasses and face the facts about the state of your organisation and business. Only by knowing the true current state can you lead your team to a better place. It says, B, say what needs to be said. Real conversations can be awkward and uncomfortable. That's true, isn't it? Sometimes having that conversation with maybe a husband, maybe a wife, maybe a son or a daughter, maybe even yourself, can be uncomfortable, especially if conflict is involved. Having the crucial conversation helps cut through the smoke and move through issues. This also means having the courage to put your opinions on the table, even if unpopular. So that's what the world is telling us. In order to be a good leader, you have to sometimes say what is uncomfortable. So what about church history? What does that tell us about conflict? Looking at the Old Testament, think about two people in particular. King David. David was king for 40 years. And what was his rule like? Well, he wasn't allowed to build the temple. Why wasn't he allowed to build the temple? Because even though he was a man after God's own heart, he was involved in conflict and warfare throughout his life. But that, thinking about it, really kept him sharp. It kept him reliant upon God, constantly crying out through the Psalms, please, God, help me. I cannot do this by myself. Whereas Solomon, his son, who built the temple, lived in peace. But did Solomon end his life? Well, he might have repented in the end. Many people believe that that's the case. But throughout the course of his life, he had 700 wives, 300 concubines, worshipped idols. So that conflict was gone. And so that reliance that his father had upon God seemed to disappear, and it went. What about throughout church history? The 16th century is the Reformation. Martin Luther, what did he have to do? He had to stand up to Rome. Rome said, error. It said that you have to do X, Y, and Z in order to be saved. And he stood up to it throughout his life. 17th century, England and Wales underwent religious strife with the Puritan movement. What was the Puritan movement about? It was all about saying no to what some of what the Church of England stood for. To say, no, we have to change the way we do things. The 18th century, what was that? Well, there was the Great Awakening. There was John Wesley in the Church of England. And this was what was said of it. Although the Great Awakening stimulated great conversions and an increase in church membership, it also provoked conflicts and division within the established church. So there we have it, once again, century by century. In the 19th century, what happened there? The Industrial Revolution. Many people came to know Christ at that time. However, the Salvation Army was formed. In 1865, they founded the movement. But then, in order to almost undermine them, there was the Skeleton Army which was formed, which was set up as a way to ridicule them, to get rid of them. And so they would cry with skulls and crossbones as their banner, blood and thunder. They would call out beef, beer and bacca, whereas the Salvation Army would say soup, soap and salvation. They would ridicule them, they would make fun of them. Moving to this century, the 20th century, once again we see conflict between those people who would truly stand for Christ and those people who would do otherwise. Martin Lloyd-Jones, as you many people will have heard of him, in 1965 he called together a debate between those people who wanted to stand at the Church of England and those people who he said should come out. And his argument was this: the World Council of Churches was contaminated. It had fellowship with those people who weren't truly Christians, and he called people out, and he lost friends. J.I. Packer was somebody who stood within the Church of England to this day, and they fell out. So however we look at it, church history, biblical history, it's full of sometimes standing up to what is evil, to what is wrong. So what does it mean today in the United Kingdom? What does it actually mean to say no to the evil deeds of darkness? What does that actually mean? Because it's very easy, isn't it? It's very easy as a Christian to say something is wrong if the world says it's wrong. As we know, Justin Welby is now the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he has stood up to what is evil, many people would say. He stood up to Wonga. People have heard of Wonga. It's if you need a bit of money and you need it quick, they'll give it to you at eye-watering rates of interest. I think it's about 400 or 500% per annum. It's usury, and it is wrong. I'm not saying, nobody says it's right. And he stood up to them, and he said that the Church of England would support credit unions to provide an alternative and very costly forms of finance. So that's what he said, and everybody in the liberal media said, brilliant, well done, that's great. And then when it came to energy prices, Justin Welby once again, he described it inexplicable how much people were paying. Once again, there's nothing wrong necessarily saying that, but what did he say when it came to gay marriage, so it's called? Well, he said that the Church of England affirms its opposition to same-sex marriage, but there is a but there. What did he say? At his first press conference, he spoke out strongly against homophobia and stated that he is always adverse to the language of exclusion when what we are called to do is to love in the same way as Christ loves us. He said, I know I need to listen very attentively to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender communities and examine my own thinking prayerfully and carefully. So what is he seeking to do there? What are we all seeking to do when we come across those difficult situations, when we have friends, when we have family who are practicing the evil deeds of darkness? What do we do? Do we say, no, I love you? I really do. But unfortunately, I cannot agree with what you are doing. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's very easy to stand up here and say that. But I've got somebody who I know, who is, I'd say, is a friend, and he is also somebody who is professionally involved with me, and he's also somebody who's practicing homosexuality. So what do you do and say? Because we have a good relationship, we have a laugh with each other, he's a very nice chap, and in many ways he's a very good person. But it's difficult, isn't it? It's only right that he be told the truth, because one day he's going to have to stand before God. One day those friends and family who are practicing the evil deeds of darkness will one day have to stand in front of God. And whose responsibility is it? Well, it's ultimately it's ours, isn't it? And if the truth is known, I think we would all, myself included, prefer not to have that conversation. I remember once driving a client to court, and I knew that she was a lesbian, and she was a very nice person. And she said to me, I looked you up on the internet. I said, okay. She said, well, I've seen some of the cases that you've done. What is your view? What is your view on lesbian relationships? And at that point in time, your heart goes in your mouth and you think, what do I do here? Do I avoid it? Do I change the subject? Do I have a bit of a joke? Well, you've really got to say the truth. In love, of course, you have to say the truth. And it's so difficult, because these days, saying the truth could result in you losing your job. Especially if you work in London, and especially, I would say as well, if you work for the council. Because we are now, as a society, given over to a heightened state of believing that the worst thing in the whole world is to criticise certain behaviours. And that's why when these police officers go out and they see a street preacher and he's preaching on these subjects, they immediately arrest him like that. Why? Because they've been constantly told, when they go back to the police station, you must stamp out homophobia. You must, anybody who says or criticises these things must be arrested immediately. They don't know what the law is, but that's what they're told. So when they hear anybody criticising these things, they will arrest. And those are the people who go out on the streets, and eventually it will filter down to everybody in this room. But unfortunately, one day we all might find ourselves in that situation, in the police cell, or maybe out of work. So, but we have to do it. We have to do it. Why? Because we are called to do it. In 2012, there were 7,000 civil partnerships in the United Kingdom. Christians don't want to speak out. So therefore, in fact, Christians are now beginning to cross the line. It's a bit like being on strike, isn't it? It's very difficult, if you're on strike, not to cross the picket line. But that's what's happening. And Steve Chalk, I don't know whether I saw him doing a debate the other day, he's somebody who has crossed that line and said he believes that if you are in a committed relationship with another person of the same gender, that's okay. It really is okay. And when he was asked to justify that, this was on a debate, he referred to Wikipedia as his source of authority. Didn't refer to the Bible, he referred to Wikipedia and tried to change the subject quickly. Did it with a lot of smiling, a lot of being very nice, because he is, he's a nice person. But it doesn't mean that it's right. And the person who was saying no, he was the one that Steve Chalk sought to make look unloving. So that's one of the evil deeds of darkness that maybe we should be confronting and speaking about. Why? Why that? Why not just talk about usury? Why not just talk about theft? Why not talk about those other things? Because the reality is, this is what the devil is using right now in order to undermine the church, to undermine marriage. This is what strikes right at the very heart of God's creation. his ordinance. And if the devil undermines that and says, actually, marriage is anything you want it to be, that really goes straight to the heart of what it means, what creation is all about. God created a man and woman from the very beginning. That's what he did, from the very beginning. And if the devil can say, actually, you know, you just do what you feel like, then that really creates a whole new playing field. Because that's what it's all about. It's all about, ultimately, if I believe it's right, then it becomes right. So it may well be, seemingly, a small topic. Only 1% of the population is this way inclined, and we're not like that in here. But what it's about is it's a way of really undermining the whole of what we stand for as a society. And that's why, as Christians, we have to speak out. And, you know, the fact is that if you do, you know, you aren't very tolerant, are you? You're a bigot. You know, haven't you gone on a diversity course? Don't you know what it's all about? Don't you know, this is not the Stone Age anymore. Come on, you know. And that's what you'll be told. You'll be told that you are old-fashioned, that you're living in the Victorian era, because this is what Christians have always been told. If you stand for the truth, you'll always be given a label. The Puritans were given a label, the Methodists were given a label in their time. Everybody who has stand for truth has very, well, say everybody, most Christians who have stood for truth have been given a nickname, which isn't particularly nice. Take another issue that we don't want to confront as Christians, and it's the issue of abortion. When I first became a Christian when I was 17, I remember speaking to my church, some of the elders, about this and asking, you know, what was the church's view, and being told that this was really not something that we did. This was a Catholic issue, and this was, it wasn't really a gospel issue. And is that true? Is it true to say that we shouldn't really be dealing with this issue? We should just be concentrating on the gospel. Well, in order to preach the gospel, I would argue that we have to confront the evil deeds of darkness. And one of the most evil deeds of darkness in this present age is abortion. Homosexuality is one, abortion is the other. Let me give you some statistics here. According to the, I think it's the Gut Maker Institute in America, 3/4 of women in 2008 reported to have a religious affiliation. 37% said that they were Protestant. And 1 in 5 abortion patients, this is in America, not in this country, 1 in 5 said that they were born again. 1 in 5. Think about that. And why is that happening? Why is that happening? Here is an email that I received from an organization which seeks to confront the reality of abortion. And it says this: another Christian woman was dissuaded from having an abortion a couple of days ago when Caroline and Kim chatted with her outside the BPAS, that's the abortion clinic, in Brighton. Please pray the mum sticks to her decision. The good news came after we heard from our London team leader, Ruth, who reported the tragic news of 2 other Christian girls ending the lives of their unborn children just a week or so ago. She continues, my Christian friend Julie rang me up and told me about a young woman she knew was pregnant and contemplating an abortion. This pregnant lady was a Christian and had the support of her family. Julie asked what my views were, as she knew that I was involved in pro-life. I told her about the strategy, what we sought to do, gave her a leaflet, encouraged her. 2 days later, I saw Julie, and she told me that when she saw her friend, she hadn't been able to show the leaflet as it was too hard. The young lady had an abortion earlier that day. That's what happens when you don't sometimes speak the truth in love. Lives are ended unnecessarily. That lady was a confessing Christian, supposedly. But because she wasn't told the truth, she went into the clinic and she took the life of her child. Talking about another lady, I asked her if her church ever spoke about abortion, and she said, no, not really. I showed her our leaflet, first the development ones, then warned her what I was about to show her was graphic. I showed her the abortion images. She chose to look, but she turned away quickly in shock. She had never seen abortion images before. She accepted my offer of prayer, and I shared my story. Then her bus came, and she thanked me, and she went on her way. Both women would have had support from their families should they have chosen life. Both women were confessing Christians. Both women were church attenders. So, there we have it. And that's the consequence of just not saying anything, because it's so easy. And that way, 200,000 abortions happen every year. 200,000. Just imagine if it was 200,000 Jewish people. Imagine if 200,000 Jewish people every year in the United Kingdom were rounded up, taken to a police station, and put to death. Or 200,000 small people, or obese people, or people with different coloured skin. Just, there'd be an outrage, wouldn't there? But it doesn't happen. The problem is that as Christians, unless we confront the evil deeds of darkness, we become more and more like the world. The abortion in the world, you're told it's fine. You can have an abortion because it's just a blob of cells. And that indoctrination starts from the very earliest ages. Until our children, who predominantly will go to secular schools, will be fed this until they believe it. And there will be no difference. Just another report, this is an email from the Big Church Day Out. The Big Church Day Out is a fun day on the south coast of England, where, as you can imagine, lots of church groups go along. And there was one of these signs outside the front of the Big Church Day Out of what it was, an abortion. It had a graphic image of a child which had been aborted. So they went outside. Starting on Friday morning, we set up two graphic abortion displays on the approaches to the Christian festival. We were under no illusion that this would make us popular, but many on the team were shocked by the way they were treated by those attending. John Rogers said, "I've never received so much abuse on a display before." The reactions ranged from people telling us we should be ashamed of ourselves, ripping up our leaflets, throwing them to the ground, to threats of taking us to court, to the guy pictured above who tore down one of our banners. And so that's outside a Christian festival. The reality is that out of all the sins that need to be confronted, I would say, far from being a Catholic issue, it really underpins our present culture. How is it that we are able to, as a society, allow the sexual immorality that goes on and not have thousands of illegitimate children? Women can dress how they want to dress. Men can behave how they want to behave. One girl here and one girl there. How can we allow this to happen? And it's getting into the church. Why? Because there is a cost. Everything comes at a cost. The chair that you're sitting on came at a cost. This Bible costs something. Everything comes at a cost. And the cost is innocent lives. Innocent lives that have to die, that have to be fed into the furnace, in order to allow that fire to keep on burning. Recently there was news that some of the hospital in our country are being partly fed by the aborted children. Because what happens when you have an abortion? Well, you've got to get rid of it. It's just medical waste. And it goes into the fires in hospitals, which then help to heat the hospital. There couldn't really be a more powerful message as to how far our society has gone wrong than that. Jesus was the ultimate innocent lamb who died for the sins of the world. He was somebody who died, although he had no sin. He died for our sins. And likewise, these children are now dying, really, because we are not saying anything. Because if people are told, then very often people stop. And I would hope especially that Christians would stop. And how are we meant to be a light in this world unless our behaviour is different? And that is probably the most crucial way we can be different in terms of how we act, with our sexual behaviour, with our families. That really has to be one of the foundation stones of where we have to turn back. You know, there is a link between confronting the evil deeds of darkness and evangelism. So it is all related to the gospel. There's a man who I've met called Greg Cunningham, and he's a lawyer by profession. He was served in the Vietnam War, and he now heads up a pro-life organization in America. And he says that he goes around campuses in America, so university campuses, and he does being crusades there, as they're called. And when Campus Crusade for Christ goes around, obviously they do their things, and they present the gospel, and there is an element of response. However, when they go there with their images, the graphic images, which are, some of them are the size of this room, when they go there, they have more response than Campus Crusade for Christ. Now, isn't that slightly ironic? Because they don't actually explicitly have Bible verses. All they are is a picture. But what it does is this, is that chink in the armour, it's like a sword that kind of goes in. When you do evangelism, have you ever been told, well, I'm not a murderer, I'm not a rapist, you know, come on. That's what people say. Because they don't actually feel sinful. We don't feel it these days, do we? But the reality is that you are a murderer. I'm sorry, but you are. If you've had an abortion, if you've contemplated it, if you've had those desires to go out and do X, Y, and Z with a girl on a Friday night, and if all, everything goes wrong, there's always that abortion. Deep in your heart, you are potentially a murderer. And this is when people are confronted with that reality, then they turn to Christ. So that is really what we are commanded to do. Going back to the prayer of Daniel, Daniel said, "Neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings and to our princes, to our fathers and all the people of the land." That's verse 6. The reality is that I say to a lot of my clients, I cannot guarantee that you will win. Doing this type of work, doing criminal law, we don't do no win, no fee. I'm sorry, we don't. Why? Because I cannot guarantee that you will win. The only guarantee that I can do is that we will fight as hard as we possibly can and make all the points we possibly can. Because the reality is we don't often get complaints, in fact very rarely at all. Why? Because we put up a good fight. And likewise, here we have, we cannot ever say necessarily that God will necessarily turn the hearts of this land back to himself, so that we have a wonderful revival. Obviously, that'd be wonderful. But the only thing that we are commanded to do is to be faithful and to speak the truth. And perhaps God will be gracious to us. Gracious to us and gracious to this country. Because otherwise, it says in verse 11, "The curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, has been poured out on us." And talks about a great disaster. And obviously back in the time that he's talking about, the disaster was the sacking of Jerusalem. The fact that they lost their land. If we're not obedient to God, there will be consequences. There will be consequences for our churches. And God is angry. He is angry about this. He is angry about the situation. As long as though he's thinking, oh, it's all right, don't worry about it. If I were to badly advise a client and say, don't worry about it, you know, we'll give it a shot, and lie to them and say, let's take it to trial, and then we lose and they spend £5,000 when they had not a hope of winning, I would get sued, because that person would be angry. If they lost after me telling them the truth, it'd be a completely different situation. They couldn't sue me. But if I told them that they had a good shot and I lied to them, then really they're only right to be angry, and God is right in a way to be angry with us. So finally, what we can do about this is pray and rely upon the righteous deeds and his great mercy. That's what it says, verse 18, "And ask God not to delay." The time is short. It really is. Right now, during the course of this meeting, although the clinics are probably closed, there's probably on average been another maybe 50 abortions, if you think about it that way. Maybe a few more people entered into a civil partnership. Now the reality is there are some people who we will never stop, but let us not fail in our duty to confront the evil deeds of darkness. And finally, in relation to our own lives, our own families, mostly spoken about evangelism and the relationship between those evil deeds and speaking out, but it's our own lives as well. And very often we need to confront ourselves, we need to look ourselves in the mirror and have that frank conversation and say, I've got to stop it. Lord, please help me to stop the evil deeds of my life. So may the Lord help us.